The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
That was impressive. I know it was kind of long for all these announcements. The part of it that made me happy was to feel the vitality and the generosity of all these people who are doing things and offering things and standing up and making announcements all the stuff that goes on here. There was a time when we, 10 years ago when we first had this building, that almost nothing happened here. So it's nice to hear all that. So, about a month ago, I started to give what will be probably once a month, a series of talks on ethics, Buddhist ethics, sila. And a month ago, I gave a talk on the first precept, which is not to cause injury, harm, not to kill. And today, I'd like to cover the second precept, which is not to take what is not given. It fits under the category of sila. Sila is the Pali word for, usually translated into English as ethics or virtue. And the one idea about this topic of sila is that when you hear it evoked, it's supposed to make you happy. You're supposed to feel joy and delight. So I doubt I'll manage to manage that in the course of our time here, but at least that's the direction we're hopefully going. That you'll come to have such appreciation of this that it will bring you joy. And this certainly was a foreign idea to me when I was a high school student or my early years, that somehow ethics would be a joyful topic. It's kind of a drag, I thought. Some of the functions or ethics, or some of the associations that the Buddhist tradition puts with ethics, is that ethics is a gift. We give people the gift, our society, the gift of safety, of trust, by living in an ethical way. So it's a nice association that ethics is not a duty, like you kind of weigh you down, but rather it's a gift that we offer to others. And the other is association with sila, ethics, is that it's a protection. It protects us and protects others as well. That's why it's safety is involved. So it protects us as an individual, because we have less to worry about if we live ethically. We don't have to worry about getting caught. We don't have to worry about defending ourselves, about retribution, punishment, whatever else comes when we do things unethically. The definition of, or the kind of the crux, or the guideline for understanding what's ethical in Buddhism is very simple, is whether or not it causes harm. Does it cause harm to yourself, or does it cause harm to others? And if it causes harm, then it's considered not sila. In English, we'd say unethical. And the point of living by sila is to avoid causing harm, and even better than that, hopefully benefiting the world around us. So in that kind of measure of ethics, Buddhism fits closer into what's called situational ethics, where it's a situation that we look at to see whether something is going to be ethical or not, because in any given situation, what causes harm and what doesn't cause harm can vary. And so we have to consider the situation we're in. And therefore, generally, Buddhism doesn't have kind of abstract ethics, moral commandments that come from outside that are supposed to be kind of overlaid on top of the experience, independent of, the situation we're there. But rather, it's based on this principle, the principle of non-harming. And so so if we look at sila, ethics, it's possible to divide it into three aspects. And the three aspects are called in Buddhism the three trainings. And the three trainings are the training in ethics, the training in, it usually says samadhi, but the training in inner cultivation, inner development of our hearts and minds, and the training in wisdom. And what's significant in Buddhism is that the emphasis is, over and over again, what we're pointing to is training as opposed to a belief system. Many people coming out of a Western religious background assume that to be a religion, any self-respecting religion, is supposed to have a set of beliefs. And if you just understand those beliefs, then you can be a card-carrying member of that religion. The Buddha in his time was very clearly put himself into a category of religious people in ancient India who did not rely on sacred texts, did not rely on a tradition, what was received from a tradition of teachers or elsewhere, did not rely on reasoning for their spiritual guidance, but instead relied on what can be known through direct experience. And he was presented himself as fairly unique in his environment as someone who discovered truths through his own direct experience, independent of any other authority figure. And in teaching then, he didn't say, well, now I know, now I'll tell you how it is. But rather what he did was he offered a training system, a technology for having the direct experience for yourself. And so so that's why training gets priority in Buddhism. Some people would say more than beliefs, because it's the training that's really important. There's a training that allows us to have liberating experiences, to understand our life in the immediacy of our life rather than abstractly. So this idea of situational ethics, to actually be present for our life as it is and then to be able to reflect and consider it, is part of this approach. And so training. So from the point of view of training, ethics involves these three different areas. Training in the ethics itself, training in inner cultivation and transformation, and training in wisdom. The first, when we look at the very... So ethics is, includes all three. If we look at the narrowest meaning of ethics... in the Buddhist early Buddhist tradition, it's most often associated with restraint. That we restrain ourselves from behavior that's going to cause harm. And sometimes it's good to have certain guidelines to make it easy for us, because sometimes we don't have the ability to look at situations and try to understand situationally what is actually the best thing to do here. So sometimes if we don't know... sometimes it's better to have default positions. And a pretty safe default positions is the five precepts. A good default is not to kill anyone, if you need one, right? A good default is not to steal. A good default is not to harm through your sexuality. Good default is not to lie. And a good default is don't get intoxicated. So for some people, it's really helpful to have those defaults and to restrain their behavior by it, because... chances are pretty high that you'll cause less harm in the world if you avoid doing those things. That it's the greater good is found by not doing those things than by doing those things. So some people practice these precepts from the point of view of restraint. We don't do these things. And some people put the very strong boundary up. I'm not going to cross that line. And part of the motivation for that is that it protects us. We're protected. We're protected from the cycles, the cycle of cause and effect. As you sow, so shall you reap. That if you lie to your friends won't trust you, and you reap that mistrust. If you steal, people won't trust you, perhaps. And I talked to someone just recently who had a family member who was involved in embezzlement, and most family members had... and that wouldn't have anything to do with this person anymore. So that's kind of, you know, a big consequence. So we protect ourselves from the deleterious consequences by following this default of restraint from crossing these lines. But ethics doesn't stop there, because what's most important, I think, in Buddhism is not that we follow guidelines or default guidelines, or even that we have to follow principles, but rather that we become transformed from the inside out, so that rather than acting ethically, we become ethical. So that the ethics becomes just how we are as a person, part of our character. Our character is changed. And that involves developing a variety of inner capacities that maybe are not so well developed. Developing a higher ethical sensitivity, a capacity of mindfulness and attention that we take in and feel and sense people and ourselves. And so in this higher ethical sensitivity, you're much less likely to want to cause harm. If you are deeply at peace and happy and relaxed and contented, and you're probably much less likely to say something spiteful or harmful to your best friend than if you're angry and upset and harried. That the quality of how you are affects the tendencies for our ethics. So we cultivate a higher inner quality of heart and mind and sensitivity, and we can cultivate such things as compassion, love, and generosity. And then wisdom has to do with understanding. This has to do with a variety of different things we can understand about the world we live in. We can understand ourselves better. We can understand what motivates us, so that what motivates us to do things in the world comes from the best inside of us rather than the worst. We can understand the consequences of our actions. And so we can understand the consequences and how our actions affect other people. And we understand the consequences and how it affects ourselves. Sometimes people who do unethical things do not consider the consequences of what they're going to do. Some of you have been here when Jacques Verdun has taught. Jacques Verdun teaches mindfulness at St. Quentin. And he has a program for inmates there. And one of the first things he does in the beginning of their program is he writes on a chalkboard how long the prisoners have been in jail. He's in San Quentin, where there's all these lifers, so, you know, 20 years, 25 years, 35 years. They've been there a long time. And, you know, there's a room full of 20 men, maybe. And so he adds up all the years together that they've served time, you know, 700 or 800, 900 years total. It's a big, big number, right? And then on the other half of the chalkboard, he says, now, how long was your period time of imminent danger, meaning how much time were you in where you were in that it took for you to be in danger to do the crime you did? You know, sometimes some of these people and they kill. You know, it wasn't premeditated murder, but you know, it was in the passion of the moment, and so they added up, and you know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, you know. And then they add up all the minutes of imminent danger that got them into trouble, and it's something like, I don't know, for the 20 men, maybe it's, you know, 90 minutes total. And they see this balance, 90 minutes versus 900 years. Those are big consequences, right? You kind of see it kind of dramatically. And he does that to train people, to emphasize the importance of being present and mindful all the time, and not to lose one's attention in these times of imminent danger. So to take the time to reflect on consequences to others, to oneself, the causes inside of us, the source, the impulses that we have. And then also part of the wisdom training is to consider, which takes work and effort and thinking, what are the alternatives to whatever thing you're going to do that might be unethical? Are there alternatives that's better for everyone, including for yourself? The wisdom side is some people don't like because it requires some work. So, there's a whole generation of Buddhists coming out of the hippie era that, you know, Mr. Natural, where, you know, you're just supposed to be naturally ethical. No work, just relax, hang out, and just, you know, changes of that way. But I think to be a responsible citizen in our society requires active consideration and thinking about this world. So three aspects of ethics, three trainings in ethics, trainings in restraint, training in transforming our character, and training in wisdom and understanding. So I would like to try to apply this to the second precept, which is taking what's not given. It's a beautiful way of stating it, because rather than saying not stealing, it has a higher order of care than not stealing. You have to actually feel or experience someone offering you something in order for you to take it. If it's not offered, we don't take it. So as a precept of restraint, it protects us, because if we take things that aren't offered, someone will probably be upset and upset with you. If you take something which is not offered, other people will feel upset, will feel hurt. It was very, very, very meaningful for me to experience the feelings my wife had after her car was broken into. She felt violated. You know, she was kind of shook her up, even though she wasn't present for the crime. The fact that it was coming into her private life. Someone came into her car, and so I think it. We were living in San Francisco then, and I think from then on, the neighborhood we lived in, she no longer felt safe. Big impact on someone. So not to take what is not given, to restrain oneself from that. One of the values of this restraint, of not restraining oneself from taking what's not given, is the value in personal mindfulness. Some people use the precept of restraint to hold back from the impulse of what they're going to do, and not to hold back just because for its own sake, but to hold back to be more carefully attentive to what are the beliefs, what are the emotions, what are the desires that are operating that would motivate us to take what is not given. And for mindfulness practitioners, this is a great thing, to have a kind of a mindfulness bell. The mindfulness bell is when you notice you're about to take what's not given. I suspect that most of you here are not too inclined to go do the big stealings, like you're probably not, you know, stealing cars and robbing banks and stuff like that. So probably in a conventional way, you're relatively ethical. But I suspect that for many people, there are certain areas that are gray areas. Some people, the stereotype of the kind of gray area for people who work for companies is the company pencil, you know. Is the company pencil offered? I'm going to work at home. I'm doing company work at home, so of course I should take the pencil home. Of course I should take the computer home. Of course I should take my whole office home. Of course I should, you know, where's the gray line? Where's the limit? Or even if it is offered, yes, you know, you could take a pencil home because you're doing work at home. And so you take 300 pencils home. They're offered, aren't they? And then you sell them on the black market. You know, yes, they're offered. They were offered, offered freely. I'm inspired by the example of Buddhist monastics. They have very strong rules by this. In fact, they're so strong, the rule against not stealing, that if a Buddhist monastic steals something of any value, I think they automatically stop becoming a monk. It's one of the most serious crimes they can do. And it translates to if you invite a Buddhist monastic, a Buddhist monk, a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni into your home, if you have a coffee table with a coffee table book, you know, that's meant for viewing and looking and picking up, you know, and your friends come over and they're sitting there happily, you know, it seems normal, natural they would look at it because it's just kind of offered in a sense. A Buddhist monastic won't pick it up, won't touch it, until it's offered, even the idea of picking something up like that crosses the line for them. And you might think it's too extreme, but I think it does two things. It heightens the mindfulness of the monastic. They get to look at their impulses and learn how not to give in to them too easily. And it makes them trustable. It means that you don't have a lot of doubts about, you know, is it okay to leave this monk in my house alone? You know, that's a person whose chances are very high that your stuff is safe. So I've gotten around this rule. As a layperson, when I have monks staying in my house, I get around this rule for them, helping them. I stand outside my house when they come, and I say, I offer you the house, whatever's there. And then, so then they know they can come in and, you know, and pick up the, we don't have a coffee table, but, you know, if they need something, they can use it. Not to take what's not given. And it might be interesting to consider some of the common areas that where people in our society take what's not given that maybe are kind of a gray area. And we wouldn't have much time now, but you might want to have a conversation with some of your friends and think about where are the gray areas in our society for this. For example, one gray area is, What if you pay a bill and they give you more change back than they're supposed to? Or what if they give you the bill at the restaurant but they left out one of the items that you ate? Well, you know, they made a mistake, right? The food wasn't very good, the service wasn't very good. You know, they let us waiting outside for a long time. And, you know, I think we deserve to get a little, you know, perk here. So I'm not going to say anything about the fact that I'm not being charged for everything. Is that taking what's not given? It hasn't been offered. Maybe it was someone's mistake. It was kind of painful for me to read a few weeks ago. I think it was in some place like Louisiana or Mississippi that the government food stamp computers broke or had a flaw so that people had this, I guess it's like this debit card for their food stamps. And it was unlimited amount. There was no limit on it. And when people in those counties got wind of enough people that, you know, there were unlimited debit cards, they went to the supermarkets and got cartloads and cartloads of food. And when the store managers thought this was really strange, I guess they called the food stamp company and department, and I guess they honored them, I guess, before they had time to close them down or change the flaw. But I thought that was kind of bizarre, kind of painful. That's clearly taking what's not given, even though, you know, it's, you know, you had access to it. So where do we have a gray area in our society for people? The second aspect of not stealing has to do with training and transforming our character, transforming our hearts and minds. Is kind of the most beautiful part, I think, of this whole ethics things, because we have the potential of tremendous beauty within us, and the purity of the beauty of a pure heart, a pure mind, the beauty of generosity and compassion and caring for others and for ourselves is very inspiring to see. I've been very inspired by people I've known who I felt had very high ethics and lived a very ethical life. And not just inspired to be ethical myself, and inspired to do this practice that we do, because the way this practice transforms our character for the better. So in terms of not taking what is not given, one of the interesting areas to explore in practice is the role of greed in taking what's not given. I think it's probably relatively safe to assume that greed often plays a role in taking what's not given. Maybe not all the times. Maybe there's other motivations as well, but often greed has some role to play. And so then, if we're interested in inner transformation, we have to come to terms with our greed, which involves the very important task of understanding it. This mindfulness path has a lot to do with understanding, and so it's good to stop and take the time to understand. It means that we don't want to be in a hurry to get rid of something like greed. Don't look for the first opportunity to abandon it. You know, look for the first opportunity to study it. Because if you let go of it too quickly, it'll probably come back. But if you take the time to get to know it, then you can begin uprooting it. Then you cannot be tricked by it in the future because you know all its tricks. So begin understanding what it feels like in your heart, in your mind, what that impulse feels like. understand what are the belief systems that are associated with it, the values that are associated with that greed, the fears that are associated with it, to really take a time to study. This is one of the first steps in this personal transformation. The second is to begin appreciating some of the opposite impulses or motivations, to begin to develop and cultivate the impulse towards generosity, to non-greed, to caring for others as well. And so we don't leave the quality of our heart, our mind, to chance in Buddhism. We don't just kind of like, you know, wake up in the morning and just kind of go ahead and live with whatever ethical sensibility we have for that day. But rather, we take responsibility for our character, and Buddhist practice is involved in changing that for the better. The third aspect has to do with understanding. So part of taking what's not given is to be engaged in the active reflection about what does it mean not to take what's not given, and where are the gray areas, or how do I understand this in my life? To become more sensitive, more attuned to paying attention to consequences of our actions. To be more attuned to paying attention to the sources within us. To be more attentive to the interconnected network of our lives that we live in. And I think this is where maybe the most amount of work needs to be done, because the consequences of our actions are not only what we can see. There's a whole, our patterns of consumption, the patterns in which we acquire our income, involves a network of interconnectedness that goes way beyond what we could actually see. And to what degree do we take responsibility for our patterns, our participation in the economic system, so that our participation is ethical? Or is out of sight, out of mind, meaning I'm ethical, I don't have to worry about what's out there, I only have to worry about what's in here. As someone said on Friday, there is, I don't know the details of this, but there's some kind of metal that is apparently in every computer that is mined in the Congo in conditions which are close to slavery for the people who are mining them. And so if people are in conditions of slavery, we're taking those things for our computers, are we taking what's not given? Oh, no, those slaves meant us to have it. You know, that they're working hard for us, thank you. And there's a lot of places, you know, sweatshops around the world, the blood diamonds in Angola, and a variety of places, you know. Are things really being offered freely, or are they basically being stolen sometimes? And if we're participating in a system like that, are we then, are we kind of involved then with taking up what's given? Are we offering the world the gift of our protection, the gift of safety, if we don't pay attention to these wider circles and wider things? So what is the economic system we're in, and how do we participate in it is important. I think that, many of us know in the last 25 years or so in the United States, there's been periodic cycles of outrage over corporate greed. Corporate greed where a corporation or an individual has basically robbed hundreds of thousands of people, some people of their life savings, because of how they invested the money, how they took the money out. So it's clearly taking what's not given. But sometimes the white-collar crimes, are not considered crimes, or sometimes there's a huge gray areas in our investment system between taking what's not given and taking what is given. And how do we participate in this system? Does your investment, does your income? What is the proper distribution of wealth in society? A system where wealthy are getting more wealthy, is that really is that a system that's taking what's not given? Is it appropriate? You know, people feel like I earned it. You know, that my board of directors gave me all this money, so it was given to me. But is a distribution of wealth freely given? I've been surprised sometimes by knowing people who received vast amounts of investment or stock options. You know, I mean, startup companies, they got either venture capitalists to offer them a lot of money, or they got they sold their stocks finally and they got a lot of money. And then they went around and bought, you know, monumentally big mansions. And is it, you know, yes, they got the money, but is that really what the money is for? When people invest into buy stocks and you sell it, are they buying the stock so you can have a big mansion? Is that taking what's not given? Is it really that what our system is set up to do, is to reward that way? So the economic system we're in, what I'm trying to do here is to raise questions, not answers, hopefully. And the questions is, what I'm trying to point to is that to be ethical and do it as the last of the three trainings requires work. Requires educating ourselves, thinking about what we're participating in, thinking about the consequences beyond what we can actually see. And that, you know, it's not going to be, you know, given to you on a silver platter and made easy for you. Look on Wikipedia and try, you know, and look, taking what's not given, all the different, you know, they explain it to you in great detail, and then you can know what to do. But it actually takes reflection. And some people are very aversive to doing this deeper education and reflection because it's tiring, they have other things to do, and sometimes because it's painful to read and learn about this thing. But that's why the second training is so important. The second training in mindfulness and transforming our character hopefully gives us the capacity to be interested to study the world we live in, to do it in a way that isn't tiring, that's inspired by our goodness, and rather than worried about guilt and rather being oppressed or weighed down by what goes on in the world, to be able to go into the world in a light way, easy way, but to do the work, to really be careful about this precept, not to take what is not given. And then if we turn it on its head, around this precept, rather than a precept of restraint, we see it as a precept of action. Generally, the tradition says the action, the reciprocal action, would be generosity, to live a life of generosity as opposed to taking what's not given. And some people say that this precept of taking what's not given implies the ethics of the gift economy, of giving to people. So instead of taking what's not given, how about practicing giving what's not asked for? Wouldn't that be nice? I think that's kind of the definition of generosity. Giving what's asked for doesn't really allow for much generosity. But if we give more than what's asked for, that's where we start talking about generosity. And wouldn't it be great if that's what everybody practiced? So, I hope that... I didn't anticipate this would make you happy, but this talk, but because my skills of presenting Sila are not that great. But that's okay, because maybe I gave you just enough information that now you could do the work of making yourself happy. So maybe today you can think about it, and by the end of the day, be really happy about this precept and your relationship to it. So, thank you.